Good day, and thank you for joining us for today's IBM teleconference, IBM Transaction Analysis Workbench. It's not just for IMS. We cover DB2, CICS, and more. Today's teleconference will last approximately 60 minutes and will include a question and answer session. Today's teleconference is being recorded. In today's teleconference, we'll explain the capabilities of an IBM tool that can help reduce the instrumentation processing of big data. Our speaker for today's teleconference will be James Martin, CTFL, U.S. Representative, Fundy Software. At this time, I would like to hand it over to our host, Margaret Wilson, IMS Tools Market Manager, IBM Software Group. Please go ahead.
Good morning, everybody. Thank you for joining us on our third IMS Tools Telecon in 2013. And I'm sure you're thinking, IMS, this is just an IMS tool? But no, it isn't. What we're talking about today is an IBM tool called Transaction Analysis Workbench. I think most of you are already aware of the tool, but what you may not be aware of is this tool is more than just IMS. This tool will help enable transaction lifecycle analysis using not only IMS, but CICS, DB2, WebSphere, MQ, SMF, and operator log data. It automates the data gathering, it makes it easier, reduces the time to get a fix, and helps you train the next generation of support personnel. So a very powerful tool that you need to know about. And the most important thing here is this is just not for IMS anymore. So with us today to tell us all about this is James Martin from Fundy. And James, welcome. I'm so glad you could join us. And with that, I will give this over to you. Thank you.
Well, thank you for that introduction, Margaret. And also thank you to everybody out there who's joining this webcast and taking time out of your day. We know your time is valuable, and we really hope to give you some value for that time you're going to spend with us today. So starting on, actually these slides are numbered starting with slide zero. The cover title slide is not actually numbered as number one, so I just want to make sure and point that out to everybody. So as I step through the slides, I will be starting with slide number one when we move off of the cover slide. As Margaret said, we're talking about the IBM Transaction Analysis Workbench today, and as she did say, it's not just for IMS, and throughout the presentation, we're probably going to see just why. So starting and moving on to slide number one, just a quick look at the agenda of what we're going to cover today. We're going to talk, of course, about the IBM Transaction Analysis Workbench for System Z. And we're going to talk a little bit about how we can use the Workbench to do several things. How we can use the Workbench to look at big data and identifying things we call transaction exceptions. Also, we're going to look at how the Transaction Analysis Workbench can be used in a collaborative environment and span all of your subsystems across your entire ZOS imprint. We're going to introduce the tool and show how it can help application development teams. And we're also going to talk a little bit about Workbench features that are coming in the future as well. Of course, I have attached a scenario for a typical problem-solving situation using IMS and DB2, which the Workbench can also help you really do well as well. So those are, of course, addendum slides, and they'll be there just for you to have a look at after the presentation is over, if you so wish. So moving on to slide two, you may have heard me or my father, Jim Martin, speak about the Workbench before, and if you are an IMS problem investigator user, you might see a lot of similarities between the Transaction Analysis Workbench and the IMS Problem Investigator in the way it does its ISPF interactive investigations. And at a casual glance, you might tend to think that the Workbench is really all about IMS, when that's not the fact at all. The fact that the Transaction Analysis Workbench is marketed by the IMS tools team might also give you the same impression that this is an IMS tool, when it's very far from that. The Transaction Analysis Workbench is a Z-based tool, and you can see from this particular foil that it is much more than an IMS tool. We've been working really, really hard at our lab in Perth, Australia, to make it span all of the transaction and database manager spaces And in terms of processing the available instrumentation data and including all of it into your life cycle views that you're so accustomed to seeing with the IMS Problem Investigator in our Investigate feature. The Workbench will accept all of the inputs that you see of the instrumentation type data on this screen here, and it provides support for all of these inputs very similar to what you're used to with the IMS Problem Investigator if you're familiar with that tool. So we'll now move on to slide 3. And one of the things we tried to address with the Transaction Analysis Workbench from the beginning is when we visit customer sites, one thing we're seeing really across the board is a reduction in skill level. We have a lot of IMS skill that is either retiring or moving on to do different things. And the skill level in some of the IMS shops that we've been visiting is really starting to be reduced. And that can be a serious issue. And how do we address that issue? Well, we are continuing to make progress in this area and expect a lot more productivity-boosting features as this product goes forward. You can see some of the things that we provide with the product are the interactive ISPS dialog log browser. It provides an interface to all types of log types, instrumentation data, and lets you do things like navigate and do some really comprehensive filtering and formatting of all types of different instrumentation data. And the products always featured automation in many areas, but as we continue to add more function and make it easier to acquire the data that you need, it becomes apparent to us that more and more automation is really needed to make this tool really useful. And it's especially true for someone like application developers that can really benefit from information that's provided by IMS and other subsystems for that fact. But these application folks may really not have the knowledge of how do I gain access to these IMS logs and the other types of instrumentation data. And so throughout the process of the tool growing, we will always continue to add new reports that are aimed at better assessment of problems and quicker, more accurate assignment of those problems to the right subject matter experts and allow application development folks to really diagnose issues they're having with applications that they might be developing. Moving on to slide 4, this is just an introduction slide. I want to point out that one thing the Transaction Analysis Workbench really hopes to endeavor to provide support for in the future is identifying transaction exceptions in the big data world. And I want to refer to an IOD presentation that's going to be given this year, IMS 1866, Your Big Data Solution is Not Complete Without IMS on System Z. If you happen to be attending the IOD conference, this would be a really good one if you want to understand what the big data world is like as far as IMS on System Z. Moving on to slide 5, well, when we go to customer shops today, it's really common for big IMS systems to create 200 or 400 gigabytes of log data a day, and many customers have more than one IMS system creating this amount of log data, and couple that with their DB2 database systems that can easily create the same amount or more DB2 log data, along with about 20 to 50 million SMF records per day. Well, that's what we would call big data, of course. And traditional tools that try to analyze all of this instrumentation data that's being created are really having a hard time keeping up with the volume of this instrumentation data. And as we enter into other concepts like cloud computing on the mainframe and the mining of traditional instrumentation data, we need to really have a new approach to the initial processing of this large amount of data that we're talking about. And with such large amounts of data to process, and with cloud processing a possibility as well, we need to adjust our approach in the way we do performance evaluations today. And we currently evaluate overall system performance. We need to consider a change to identification of transactions that are beginning to show signs ahead, not necessarily that are giving us problems now, but will they possibly give us problems in the future? Well, how do we identify that? And how easy will it be to find these transactions when they become critical issues? Our online monitors that we have today, tools like OmegaMon and MainView, they're set to alert us when there's a transaction causing problems. But by the time the online monitors identify these issues, it's usually a crisis situation that demands immediate attention. And how could we possibly catch the problem before it becomes a crisis? And boy, if we could, it sure might be easier to solve and or to even avoid that crisis problem situation altogether. A couple of things we're really hoping to address with this particular tool. Now we're going to move on to slide 6. And now we're going to talk a little bit about the cloud. And when it comes to the cloud, most of the customers that we talk with envision transaction processing in multiple locations within their enterprise, and we call this the cloud. In some cases, the multiple processing locations, they have different cost factors, so it's better for particular transactions to maybe execute on a lower cost location unless that higher cost location is needed for backup or for capacity reasons. Maybe during your high-capacity processing periods, you really, really have to have that higher-cost location just because capacity dictates. And then when that capacity is not needed, it's really, really better to run those transactions on the lower-cost option. Well, exception processing inside the transaction analysis workbench is really designed to deal with both of these issues. It crawls the data instrumentation, and it's looking for transactions that meet your exception criteria. And when one of these transactions is found, an index segment is then built into or created from the raw instrumentation data, rather. And you can examine these exceptions to see if additional diagnostic is needed or warranted. The process can also provide a picture of transaction execution locations. And in that way, you can ensure that your cloud distribution goals are being met, whatever those might be in your shop. Moving on to slide 7, we're going to talk a little bit about that index that I mentioned on the previous slide. And what we're talking about when we talk about an index in the terms of the transaction analysis workbench, we're talking about a transaction index. And a transaction index is a workbench term for a file whose record contains the information about transactions for any particular subsystem. Well, in some subsystems, such as CICS and DB2, they natively generate log records that serve this purpose. For KICS, for example, it's the SMF-110 or the CMF performance records. And for DB2, you have the IFSID-3 records, which are the DB2 accounting records. And the DB2 can write this to either an SMF-101 or a GTF dataset record. But for IMS, there really is no single log record type that contains information spanning a complete IMS transaction. So for IMS, Workbench consolidates multiple log records for each transaction into one IMS transaction index record per transaction. And this record contains any additional calculated field values that don't exist in the individual IMS log records. And also, it really includes overall transaction response time, which is most of the times really crucial when we're doing exception processing. And rather than parsing all the fields in every record, which can be expensive, Workbench exception processing is really optimized to look at only the fields necessary to identify records that belong to an exception. Now, these exception criteria are based on specific criteria, such as long response time or ABIN, that's specified by you, the customer. And the result is that you get a file that's much smaller than the original instrumentation data and contains only the exceptions that we're interested in analyzing. Because let's face it, in today's world, time is something that a lot of the SMEs out there really don't have a lot of. So they don't want to spend a lot of time looking at a lot of transactions that ran well. They only want to see the ones that are running outside of these exception criteria that they've specified. We've also, with the Workbench, given you the ability to opt to specify criteria for any field, But, of course, that's always going to be more expensive than the default, which is that tightly focused exception processing. Now we move on to slide 8 here. And just another slide talking a little bit about exception processing and creating those transaction index. Well, to create an IMS transaction index, as I said, the workbench consolidates multiple IMS log records into one record per transaction, and each record in an IMS transaction index represents one IMS transaction and contains the cumulative information from the IMS log about that transaction. Now, a CICS transaction index is really simply a set of extracted CMF performance or SMF 110 records that's sorted by transaction start time, and there's no change to those original record structures. And the DB2 transaction index, which is not available now but is coming in the future of the product, is also simply a set of extracted DB2 accounting or SMF 101 IFKID3 records, and no change to those original record structures there as well. Moving on to slide 9, the next section we're going to talk about is why does ZOS transaction analysis need to be collaborative and span multiple ZOS subsystems? Well, moving on to slide 10, it's really all about application evolution. And if we go back to the 1980s, you can see that transactions back in the 1980s were relatively simple, at least by today's standards anyway. You had your users, which were usually company employees. You also had a transaction manager, IMS, DBDC, or CICS. And most of the time, your data was being stored or accessed from IMS database. And later on in the 80s, of course, accessing DB2 and storing your information on DB2 as well. But you could see just by this picture, by today's terms, this is a relatively simplistic transaction environment, and it was pretty easy for there to be one person that could be a subject matter expert on this entire process. But if we go and look at today, data is often complex and heterogeneous and distributed. Your users can now not only be company employees, they can be customers out in the public, can be automated systems. You still typically have that transaction manager, either IMS or CICS, but now your data can be stored in several different places. It can be stored in DB2, IMS, can be served off-host on non-Z servers or in WebSphere. And not only that, you now have the ability for things like IMS to actually call out to the Internet or to the web and receive information back. So you can now see that in today's world, it's much more difficult for you to have one person that could be a subject matter expert on all of the facets of these complex and heterogeneous environments. Moving on to slide 11, the tools that we see in this complex environments today are very silo-oriented, which means there's some great tools out there like the CICS Performance Analyzer, the IMS Performance Analyzer for IMS, the DB2 PE tool for DB2, and each one of these tools is really, really good in their own environment. The problem is that since these tools are so well suited in their own environment, they don't look outside of that environment very often or very well. And one thing that we've heard from customers for a long, long time is if I have a transaction that's initiated by CICS and reaches out and touches IMS, DB2, and or MQ, well, the tools that are out there today want to show me that instrumentation data as four separate transactions. Well, that's not four transactions. That's one transaction. And I need a tool that will show me that as one transaction. And while those tools today are very, very effective, they're very silo-oriented, as I said, from a standpoint of you have each particular expert in their own field using a particular tool, but only looking at a very narrow perspective from an instrumentation data perspective. And as we move on to slide 12, the ZOS transaction performance is really a complex subject, and it can involve many, many issues. And solving a performance issue can take longer if it's really not clear who owns that problem. Some issues might be specific to one particular subsystem, i.e. KIX or DB2 or IMS. And in those cases, like I said on the previous slide, those silo-oriented tools are very effective. But some problems may arise from interactions between subsystems. And that's where we get into an issue of where those silo-oriented tools are not very effective. Some other issues might be caused from outside events, subsystems that aren't directly involved with transaction activity, like MVS events, such as if you have a system-wide dump being taken and the system goes non-dispatchable for a second. Well, you've just added 1 second onto all of the overall transaction processing times for every transaction across the board, but and nothing that was even caused by the subsystem. Well, in a heterogeneous system like the one we see on this slide, that uses KIX, DB2, IMS, and VSAM, how could you quickly identify the cause of a performance issue and assign it to the appropriate subject matter expert, or SME, to solve it with using possibly his silo-oriented tools? And also, how do you determine whether a performance issue was caused by a particular subsystem, interactions between subsystems, or by some external but related subsystem? As I said, the subsystem-specific analysis tools can offer perspectives if you use them, but they're really often too narrow to be effective. Like a KIX administrator might look at a KIX-specific report generated from CMF or SMF records and conclude, well, it's not a KIX problem. A DB2 administrator might do the same thing, look at a specific DB2 report and conclude, well, it's not DB2. Well, to effectively analyze the performance of a KIX DB2 transaction, for instance, you really need to be able to track its activity across all of the relevant subsystems, seeing timestamps, seeing the entire transaction lifecycle, and be able to step through that lifecycle and see timings between events. Very, very crucial to see that overall picture. As I keep saying, these analysis tools have not really kept pace, and no one of these tools can look across the entire transaction. And analysis between silos involves these experts communicating with one another, and the one thing that really eats up a lot of their times is when they're using these individual tools, each expert goes out and collects his instrumentation data, and he runs his tool set against it to determine whether it's a problem in that area, be it DB2, ZOS, CICS, it doesn't really matter. But when he determines that it's not a problem in his area, he then hands that problem over to another subject matter expert, maybe the IMS systems programmer, and he now has to go out and collect all of his instrumentation data and run his tool set against it to determine whether it's an IMS problem. Well, you can see by what I'm talking about, that's a reoccurring problem, and that's just time that need not be spent. And on this particular slide, we're talking about log data on this slide, but log is a generic term, really, for any instrumentation data that's recorded by a subsystem. For example, the ZOS log encompasses ZOS-specific SMF records and OPER log. But it's often the case where the different silos are using the different sets of instrumentation data to work on the same problem. And, well, how can we be sure those subject matter experts are even looking at the same data? Well, we don't, because they're all collecting it individually. Did one have the timestamp, maybe the time of the collection, off by a minute or off by 30 seconds? Well, that can be a pretty significant amount of time with the amount of instrumentation data that we see created today. And, of course, they are all usually looking at it from an issue of, well, I'm trying to determine that it's not my problem so I can give it to somebody else. Moving on to slide 14, in today's customer shops, we see staff sizes getting smaller and smaller, and many of the current SMEs are leaving the workforce, and skills are getting harder and harder to teach and or find. And going forwards, we really, really have to find a better and smarter way to solve problems and to train new technical staff. Well, the workbench is also really designed to do a couple of these things by providing some things that would allow less skilled staff to be more productive. Because the kids coming out of school today, when I talk to those guys, they want to be able to do a couple of things. They really want to be able to come out of school, use the training that they've been working so hard to obtain, and they want to be productive members of the team, and they don't want to have to wait 2 or 3 or 5 years to be that productive member of the team. They really, really want to be supportive, productive members of the team immediately. And we hope that the workbench can help to bridge the support gap between these folks, between these lesser skilled employees, and help them gain knowledge from these SMEs that have been around for quite a while and help them pick up things much, much quicker. We also hope to bridge the support gap between things like systems programmers and DBAs and the application development staff. And we're going to talk a little bit more as we go through the presentation of how application development teams can be helped by the workbench and see some foils later on that as well. Moving on to slide 15, going back to the collaboration subject between the subject matter experts, one of the most common issues that we see with collaboration is that a subject matter expert that's asked to help may have to spend, like I said, several hours just collecting data. And to get to the same point that the previous SME is in the diagnostic process. Well, with the workbench, we've really removed this obstacle by automating the collection of the data. And that in that effort, TAW will have already collected and obtained the data needed by any of the asked SME needs. This means that the asked subject matter expert should be able to quickly look at the issue, determine if their involvement is justified or needed. And by doing this, the workbench really provides a framework that spans the silos that we were talking about and effectively dissolves barriers between that silos, makes it very easy for these subject matter experts to communicate with one another. And maybe when that problem is passed from one subject matter expert to the other, he starts to look at it as, oh, well, it won't take me long to look at this problem. The data's already there. I just need to have a quick look to determine whether it's really my problem or if it's not. And if it's not, maybe I can help determine which subject matter experts it does need to be assigned to and pass it on to them. And once again, that data will already be there for them to quickly pick up that investigative process where the last subject matter expert left off. Experts don't have to work on a problem at the same time. One expert can perform an analysis and then reassign that issue to another expert who can pick up that previous analysis where the last expert left off. And it's really a powerful tool in that area. And bridging the gaps of that silo is just something that has to happen moving forward in the future when we talk about transaction performance issues. Moving on to slide 16, we're going to go into talking specifically about what this offering or tool has to provide you from a transactional performance analysis standpoint. Moving on to slide 17, something that we have talked about with the product for a long, long time is the way it enables first responders to become effective parts of the team. And a first responder could be a lot of people. Depending upon the size of your shop, how problems are handled, a first responder can be anyone from a call desk, a help desk, to a subject matter expert. And one thing that we have to understand when we talk about subject matter experts is they may be skilled or they may be less skilled. So how can we help those people become productive members of the team immediately as well? Well, one way that we do this with the transaction analysis workbench is by collecting and automating that data collection. We also provide a lifecycle view of transaction across those subsystems. It uses SMS SMF trace and log records to follow transaction flows, and just a lot of things that help that first responder, no matter who it is, become a much more productive member of the team, basically. Moving on to slide 18, in this section we're going to discuss how Workbench can help those application development teams bridge the gap between them and the systems programmers and really become more productive and be able to test and tune their own applications as they're developing them. Moving on to slide 19, one of the worst things that can happen for a major new application or a new application release is it to be rolled out and then fail due to performance reasons. And let's face it, how many times have we seen this actually occur and happen? Well, it happens quite a bit in today's world, actually, surprisingly. And if the performance issues aren't caught soon, it can be, one, extremely expensive, or two, maybe even impossible, to revert back to the previous release of that application. And one of the questions we really have to ask ourselves is, could this problem have been caught during release testing? And if it could have been caught, why wasn't it? Why was it missed? Well, if the application teams, say, would have had automated ways to address the performance evaluation of these release tests, would that be of benefit to them? And, you know, they may have received help from the systems programming staff in the past, but with all the staff reductions that we're seeing in today's world, is it becoming more difficult to get time from these systems programming staff? Well, I think the answer to that question is absolutely a yes. So how can we enable these application development teams to be much more self-sufficient to test their own releases before they're actually rolled out? Moving on to slide 20. Well, the Workbench can provide application teams the ability to evaluate the performance of their the release testing on their own. And the product can also help you here, and they want to and are willing to help. And also, it would make the subject matter expert or the system programmer's time much more shorter when they are asked for help. We just want to grow the product in a way that provides value so that it could really use more partnerships with application development teams to make this a really effective tool for those application development teams. Because as it sits now, we really don't know the answer to that question. Have we provided value in this area? It's really something we're looking to work with some customers to find out. Moving on to slide 21, this is just a slide that shows some of the typical inhibitors that we've seen over the process and how TAW, or the Transaction Analysis Workbench, can help you to overcome these inhibitors. A couple of the key points on here, the value of the instrumentation data. First of all, does the application development team really understand what the value of the instrumentation data is? And even if they do understand the value of that instrumentation data, they may say to themselves, well, I understand that I need to see this these particular SMF records, but how in the world do I collect them? How do I obtain that data? You know, they might have limited or no knowledge of any of the tools that collect that instrumentation data and how to use them. So they can't get that data by themselves, and a lot of times they're limited in the amount of data they can even look at. They have limited access to that data. Not only that, in today's world, we're seeing more and more limited access to system programmer time, as we mentioned before, and they're reluctant to bother those systems programmers because they know those guys are usually swamped as well. So you can see the issues that are really out there and some of the things we hope that the Workbench can help overcome. This is slide 22 that shows how we hope the Workbench can help. First of all, we've automated the collection of all that instrumentation data. So even whether they think it's valuable, know it's valuable, or want to hope it's valuable, they can at least go out and collect that data. And all they really have to know is the time frame, where that data is being run in their test systems. They typically will know that. They need to know a time frame. And then they can go out and collect all of that instrumentation data and see the performance metrics, run reports against it. The Workbench gives you the capability to run reports from a couple of other products as well. If they're a Kix PA customer, they can initiate Kix PA reports. If they're an IMS PA customer, they can initiate IMS PA reports. And that's in addition to the already robust group of reports that are provided standalone in the Workbench. As we mentioned before, you can analyze that data for specific exception criteria. That's pretty useful. And not to mention the most important thing from an application development team, it provides a transaction lifecycle view with timings between events. So I can identify what part of that transaction using this application is really causing me the problem. And that might save you time on validation testing runs. And I can also collaborate with those systems programmers and other DBAs and other members of the team just by using this centrally located instrumentation data that I've already collected, passing it to them, asking them to look at something really quick. Can you give me a hand with this? Less time is used on all fronts, and we all know that's valuable. Moving on to slide 23, once again, summary of the application team benefits, the automated data acquisition, the autonomics, which includes the transaction indexes, the exception criteria, reporting, collaboration. Anyway, I don't need to read all the bullet points off of this. They're here for you to peruse at your leisure. Moving on to slide 24, this is the section where we're going to talk about some of the new features that will be coming in the Workbench. And I have to put a disclaimer on this, is that until the actual product is released, some of this is what we call futures. So I can't guarantee that any or all of this will be released until it actually becomes generally available. One of the things we want to provide much more extensive support for are DB2 IFKID data. Typically, you can see more than 60 IFKIDs that are supported. Well, that's not necessarily true. And in the future, we hope that all instrumentation facility component identifiers, or IFKIDs, are supported. And beyond those 60 IFKIDs that we support today, other IFKIDs will be supported with a generic knowledge module. And just to give you a little bit of more information, a knowledge module is how the ISPF interactive analysis portion of the Workbench formats each particular IFKID trace record or IMS log record. Each one of these IFKIDs and IMS log records has its own knowledge module or several versions, release-specific knowledge modules, that it allows it to format that and show you some very detailed information about those log records. And they say they format each field in the standard header sections, but present this IFKID data to you, specific data, as sections, as hex dump, rather than individually formatted fields, that generic knowledge module that I'm talking about. For other specific, record-specific knowledge modules, you get that individually formatted field version that gives you a lot of detailed information. Once again, I want to mention that InfoSphere Big Insights, the IOD session, IMS 1866, and suggest that you have a look at that, at some of the other things that we're going to provide. Also, you can see workflows and session templates. These workflows will allow subject matter experts to define a workflow to less skilled or help desk people that gives them a sequence of analysis tasks that allow them to go out and do things like collect the data and run some basic reports against it, maybe even look at some metrics of those reports, and basically making that first responder or less skilled person an immediate impact on the team and allowing them to feel like they are a necessary part and of the team and allowing them to do some tasks that will allow them to gain knowledge as well. We also hope to deploy an Eclipse-based rich client platform, which we'll talk about in a few slides later. But this Eclipse-based offering will be primarily aimed at the first responders and allow them to do some pretty basic things like create a session, run a workflow, and assign to appropriate subject matter experts. Also coming is automated SMS file selection and some other things as well. Moving on to slide 26, this is an example of the new DB2 trace or the DTR log record type for these IFKID records that I'm talking about. And these are generated from different types of SMF records, 101s, 100s, from GTF data set records. But you can see that the log codes that are shown in the very first column here next to this red dotted X, the 058s and the 061s, for the new DTR log type now match the corresponding IFKID record numbers. Well, this is interesting. One of the things that we hear from a lot of our DB2 customers is one of the things that I really need to understand moving forward in a DB2 environment is what exactly is going on in things like stored procedures. Well, this is an example of a Rex exec that will be provided with the sample library in the transaction analysis workbench, using the Workbench Rex API to get a list of tracked records for a transaction and then to arrange them in a hierarchy. And we can see that the trigger here was the result of an SQL delete select statement that's, in this case, is stored inside a stored procedure. The nested visual perception makes these relationships clear, and the plan is to currently this Rex exec only recognizes start and end record pairs of DB2 trace records, which is the DTR type that we saw in the previous slide. And however, this technique really could be used to extend to other log types as well. And it's really useful for understanding and diagnosing activity that's nested in storage procedures, which in this case was the trigger. And I want to point out that in this specific example, there are duplicate IFKIDs, 233s and the 380s, as you can see over on the right over there, which both record stored procedure entry and exit. And in this particular Rex exec, we've chosen to recognize the IFKID 233 as the master and have demoted the IFKID 380 to a non-start end pair. But in some sites may not collect 233. They may only collect the 380s. And it's pretty straightforward to adjust this exec to just show the 380s and not the 233s. But what's more really intricate about this is that we can now look at this particular SQL delete select statement and step through it from a hierarchy. We can also see over on the right the blue times are elapsed times between these events. And now we can really see if there was a delay inside of this particular stored procedure, where those delays occurred inside that stored procedure. Very, very powerful and something that they've been requesting from the DB2 side for quite some time now. Stepping on to slide number 28, here's an example of that Eclipse-based rich client or a GUI that we plan to offer as a feature in the product. And as I said, it really implements a subset of features that are already available in the ISPF dialog. But from our perspective, the people that might be using this, the first responders or the help desk, for instance, might really not be comfortable using that ISPF environment, and they may not even know how to log on to ISPF. Well, they can now use a GUI-based Eclipse-rich client and really be much more comfortable and do things like submit JCL tasks from a workflow, automated collection of data, assignment to subject matter experts by building sessions and things like that. There won't be any log browsing ability from the first release of this particular Eclipse-based platform. Moving on to slide number 29, this feature extends the existing support for automated file selection, as you can see here, which currently includes IMS and DB2 logs. Coming in the future, we're going to include the ability to automate the collection of SMF records as well. And this foil just points out the fact that that's what we're going to do. And a lot of times, I just want to point out that users really might not even need to know the system names because the subject matter experts can just specify, well, this transaction executes on this IMS transaction manager. It accesses this DB2 system, this MQ system. So really all they have to know is that this transaction belongs to a specific group and or, you know, however the subject matter expert identifies it. He can bring up a pop-up box, put in that group name. He's already got the systems and subsystems populated for the collection of all of that data right there. He's off and running. Well, the summary of what we've talked about today with the Transaction Analysis Workbench is how this particular tool can help save you time and money and enables collaborative problem solving and improves confidence in problem definition, determination, and assignment. Because in today's world, another thing we find with subject matter experts is that a lot of times when a problem's assigned to them, they look at it and say, wow, how much confidence do I really have that this is a problem that should have been assigned to me? And a lot of times when you ask them, the answer to that question is, I don't have a lot of confidence that it really should have been assigned to me, because all that help desk or first responder ever does is open up a problem ticket and assign it to me. And that's usually the step. Hopefully, we've provided some real value to allow that problem determination to be much more specific and give that subject matter expert some confidence that when that problem is assigned to me, it is my problem. And they've already collected the data for me. All I've got to do is look at any reports I've asked them to run and go out and start my deep dive expert analysis. And once again, thank you for joining us today. I'll move on to slide 31, which will give you some more information, websites, and my contact information, my father's contact information. John Hansey is the architect of this product, his contact information as well. And I, once again, I thank you for your valuable time today. And at this particular time, I'd like to hand the presentation back over to the operator.
Thank you, James. Now we would like to ask you to participate in a brief electronic survey. Right after the survey, we will have a question and answer session. Your feedback is important to us, and we do appreciate the time you take to answer these questions. To participate, simply press the star key followed by the number that best corresponds to your choice. Please listen to all options before making your selection. For our first question, please evaluate your level of satisfaction with today's teleconference. If it was high, press star 1. If it was medium, press star 2. If it was low, press star 3. And we'll stand by to allow everyone a chance to respond. And our second survey question, was the level of technical information presented in this teleconference? If it was at the right level, press star 1. If it was not technical enough, press star 2. If it was more technical than I needed to hear, press star 3. And again, we'll pause briefly to allow everyone a chance to respond. And for our third survey question, as the system programmer responsible for transactional analysis, would you like to be able to more easily identify problems caused by external events and pinpoint the cause of the problem? If yes, press star 1. If no, press star 2. If not sure or need more information, press star 3. And again, we'll pause for just a moment. And for our fourth survey question, do you have the need for a tool that provides interactive analysis that enables you to track an individual transaction and identify the significant events in its life cycle? If yes, press star 1. If no, press star 2. If not sure or need more information, press star 3. And our next survey question, would you like to be able to reduce the time it takes to locate the various offline data sets and files required for batch reporting and interactive problem diagnosis? If yes, press star 1. If no, press star 2. If not sure or need more information, press star 3. And for our final survey question, we hope you have enjoyed the teleconference today. Please let us know if you're interested in receiving information on this solution. If yes, press star 1. If no, press star 2. And that will conclude today's survey. Thank you all for your participation. And now we'll move to your questions. If you have a question today, please press the star key followed by the digit 1 on your telephone at any time. And we'll pause for just a moment. At this time, I'll turn the call back over to our speaker while we wait for questions. And our first question today comes from Hari Shagmugnachin. Please go ahead.
Thank you. James, one of the pages that you didn't discuss is the IMS-DB2 transaction sort of scenario that follows your material. And I had this, because I looked at it in advance, on page 37, there's a trace of events, and there are some points on the side. And I was a little bit confused because point number 4 seemed to be saying that the underlying problem was a table space scan. Yet when I look at the trace records on page 37, it sort of looks as if the big jump in elapsed time is between DB2 update space map and the first of the stored procedure exits and then the stored procedure name, and that's about 0.35 seconds. So I was wondering if you could elaborate on the point 4 and the trace records and the sort of delta in time.
Yeah, sure. I definitely see the point that you're saying where you see the jump in the time frame. Dad, do you think you can probably explain this a little better than I can?
And he has disconnected at this time, Mr. Martin. We'll see if he dials back in.
Oh, okay.
So are we talking about some different person?
Yes, yes. My father, Jim Martin, is also on the call.
Oh, I see. Sorry.
But I'm not terribly familiar with the DB2 space, and we really need to look into this issue. I was not aware of this being a point on this foil. I actually should have looked at these foils, and I didn't. I didn't realize they had put bullet points on the side, because usually the focus of this is just the fact that you can look at the entire life cycle of the transaction here and see where that elapsed time jumped. I was not aware that they actually pointed to the fact that it was a table scan issue and were actually trying to diagnose the issue on the screen. We usually don't present it that way.
Well, so, because I must admit that that is a very interesting thing because, you know, that's what you'd hope to be able to do.
Yes, I agree wholeheartedly. I would just not be the DB2 expert to be able to explain to you if that is, in fact, what the issue was in this case.
Oh, okay.
But you can clearly see that the 0020, which is a DB2 log record, there's a significant jump in time between that and the first stored procedure. It looks like a exit record, the 233.
Yes.
Record there, entry. Yeah, entry and exit. So maybe what I would gather a little bit from this foil was that something happened between that DB2 update space map and the entrance into the stored procedure. Now, what that delay would be might not be so easy to see from the instrumentation data that I had here, but if I was a DB2 expert, I might be able to take this information now and use my DB2-specific tools to further investigate that to maybe get a better handle on what that delay was.
Okay.
And in the future... Oh, go ahead. I'm sorry.
So could I ask, since you or the organizers have my email, for someone to send me an explanation?
Oh, sure. Absolutely. Absolutely. If you'd like to direct the question directly to me through the contact information in the presentation, I can definitely get you an answer to that question.
Oh, okay. So that's on foil number 31.
Yeah, that's correct.
Foil number 31. Send email. Okay, thank you.
And
thank
also
you.
To let you know, Mr. Martin, the other Mr. Martin has rejoined.
Okay.
This is Jim Martin. Had a little problem unmuting my phone. You know, in some of these cases, since they were contrived cases, we know that the problem was the DB2 table scan of the stored procedure. But you notice in this particular lifecycle view, there's not a lot of, there's a lot of additional IFKit information that would really spell out what was going on if it was available. Now, we all know that, you know, unless you're running IFKits out to GTF or something, you're not probably going to have all those IFKits active at once, but if you were able to run it in a test environment something or for a very limited time in production, say 5 or 10 seconds, collecting the necessary IFKids, then you could get a better picture of what was really going on. And that may be what we're trying to do here with this particular slide.
Thank you.
But we will get you... as James pointed out, he'll get you a much more in-depth explanation of what four was specifically referencing.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
And moving on, our next question comes from Mahesh Vasudevan. And as a reminder, it is star one to signal for questions. And please go ahead, sir.
Yeah, thank you so much. This is Mahesh from JPMC. You mentioned about this transaction manager tool that for IMSDC or CACS that can interface with the SMS record of a DB2 or IMSDB or WebSphere MQ. My question is, does it support for the queue replication software also, which is of WebSphere and DB2, or it does not support that?
Dad, you're probably better to answer that question than I am.
Well, let me make sure I first understand the question. Are you, in terms of WebSphere MQ, are you referring to the degree of support that the product has for WebSphere MQ?
Rather, we have another tool from IBM, which is called IBM QRep, queue replication,
mm-hmm.
from one system to another system to take from some of the log records and apply onto a different system. That's
okay.
What the tool does. That tool is made up of with WebSphere MQ and DB2. That's what the tool does, but I'm not sure whether this transaction manager do have that kind of capability to interface with that tool or not.
Right. Now, what the workbench provides in terms of support for Web3MQ is in two phases. We support all of the SMF accounting information recorded by Web3MQ during its execution. And so we can include that data in the lifecycle evaluation of the activity that Web3MQ dealt with in terms of the transaction. We also support for persistent queues all of the Web3MQ log data, which, as you probably know, is effectively the DB2 logger, and include all of that particular information as part of the lifecycle view. That would include the IMS used when the IMS bridge is being used with the Web3MQ, and also when an application is using the explicit interface to Web3MQ, such that any calls made by the application are included in the IMS sync point environment, you would all see all of the message queue puts and gets and the timings associated with all of that. So to the extent that this particular tool that you're talking about actually is putting writing data to a WebSphere queue using a persistent queue, then we should have no problem identifying the things that that tool did from the WebSphere log. Now, we personally have probably not tried that, so that's just an expectation on my part.
Thank you so much.
And as a reminder, we would like to ask you to press star 1 to signal at this time if you do have any questions, and we'll pause for just a moment. And it does appear at this time we have no further questions. I will turn the conference back over to our presenters for any additional or closing remarks.
Yeah, I just want to once again thank everyone for taking time out of their day to listen to this presentation, and I really hope that you got some valuable information out of it, and thank you so much.
And that will conclude today's program. Thank you all for your participation.